Coming up, a Catholic bishop in Arizona on that state's new immigration law. And are the textbooks used in Texas schools written with a liberal bias? The majority of the state school board says yes and wants big changes. Others say that's not the school board's job.
Standards should be written with people who work with the kids every day, who are professionally trained to do this sort of thing.
Plus, author Mary Carr, who emerged from a troubled life to become a Catholic.
I thought I had a better shot at becoming a pole dancer at 40, right, than making it in the Catholic Church.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. In Arizona, a tough new immigration law is prompting widespread protests from many in the religious community. It requires police in the state to check the status of anyone they suspect may be in the country illegally. To protest it, many in the faith community have designated this weekend as a special time for prayer for immigrants. Among those condemning the law are the U.S. Catholic bishops, who have long lobbied for comprehensive immigration reform. We want to talk now with one bishop on the front line of the battle. He is Gerald Kikanis, bishop of the Roman Catholic Diocese of Tucson, Arizona. Bishop, welcome. Several lawsuits were filed this week. More are promised, more are in the works, some of them from clergy. Where does the church stand on this? Are you going to try to stop this bill, this law?
Even though Arizona legislators, Bob, are considering modifications to the bill, which suggests that they themselves are concerned about how it could be misinterpreted. So there will be legal action, certainly, and we'll monitor that and participate where we feel it would be appropriate.
Do you think the church might become a party to the lawsuits to try to stop the bill?
I don't know that we'll be bringing the lawsuits forward. Those will be brought forward by certainly others. But we will review those and perhaps consider being a friend of the court where it would be appropriate.
Do you think in the end that the bill can be stopped, the law can be stopped?
Well, there is great national concern, certainly concern within our state, among religious leaders, among many portions of our community. It has to be addressed that this bill does not well represent the state of Arizona and is not going to resolve the issues that we are facing.
Bishop, remind us again of what the church says, what Christian teachings say about the stranger.
Every Christian tradition speaks of the importance of welcoming the stranger, that every human being is to be treated with dignity and respect. And so for us in the church, that is a core message of our teaching, that all human life from conception till natural death is to be respected. And certainly the migrant is among those who are the littlest and weakest among us, and they need to be respected and treated with the dignity they deserve.
But as you know perhaps better than anyone, people feel so strongly about this. Many people in Arizona, they want to stop the illegal immigration. They want to get rid of some of the people who are already there. They fear crime. They feel changes in culture. You've been getting a lot of calls, I'm sure. What do you say to people? Many of them, I'm sure, your friends, who say, we disagree with you on this.
Well, certainly I first have to listen, to hear what they are feeling, their concerns, their worries, and then try to help them to see what the church is teaching, because a lot of times people haven't really heard what is being said or haven't read the law. And so it's important to encourage them to learn about the situation, understand it better, and most important, if they could come to meet the migrant, I think some of their fears and concerns would be alleviated.
Bishop Gerald Kikanis of Tucson, Arizona. Many thanks. In other news, the U.S. Supreme Court this week ruled 5-4 that a Christian cross may be permitted to remain on land that was once public, but which Congress transferred to private owners in order to try to avoid church-state issues. The case concerns a cross that World War I veterans erected more than 75 years ago in the Mojave National Preserve. A federal district court in California rejected the land transfer as a sham. The Supreme Court ordered the lower courts to reconsider that. The majority opinion did not rule on whether permitting the cross was an endorsement of religion, but three of the dissenting justices said it was. The ruling was narrowly focused, but the wording and the lineup of justices suggests the cross ultimately will be allowed. This week, a Senate committee grilled Goldman Sachs executives about their role in the worldwide financial crisis, and the full Senate began debating new restrictions on financial institutions. Meanwhile, some faith-based groups have initiated a new lobbying campaign called Our Money, Our Values. They plan prayer vigils and protests around the country to demand that banks do more to protect Americans hurt by unemployment and the mortgage crisis. In Washington, President Obama announced a new exchange program between the U.S. and predominantly Muslim countries. The program will bring Muslim business people and social entrepreneurs to this country, while American professionals will visit the Middle East, Turkey, and Southeast Asia. The announcement came near the one-year anniversary of Obama's speech in Cairo, where he promised efforts to bridge the divide between the U.S. and the Muslim world. The State Department's special representative to Muslim communities, Farah Pandith, told a Washington audience that the new exchange program is one of many practical steps the administration is taking to reach out to Muslims. The U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom issued its annual report about the countries which severely restrict religious liberty. Among the worst violators, once again, were North Korea, Saudi Arabia, China, Iraq, and Iran. But this year's report also included some criticism of the U.S. It said the priority the White House and the State Department give to religious freedom, quote, seems to shrink year after year. In Haiti, a judge has dropped kidnapping charges against the 10 Americans who had tried to take children out of the country after the earthquake. 9 of the 10, most of them Southern Baptists, had already been released from prison. The leader of the group, Laura Silsby, has remained in jail since January. The judge said she will be charged with a lesser offense of arranging illegal travel. He said she did not have the proper identification for the 33 children for whom the group was planning to arrange adoptions. If convicted, Silsby faces up to 3 years in prison. At the Vatican, Pope Benedict XVI addressed the spreading sex abuse scandal by telling priests to protect children in their communities from evil and to work hard to win the trust of their congregations. Meanwhile, as some Catholics around the world this week continued to show their support for the Pope, others expressed their outrage as new allegations of abuse and cover-up continued to surface. A lot of eyes in Texas have been trained in recent months on the state school board, which is required to review children's textbooks every 10 years. This is a review year, and the conservative majority on the board has proposed more than 100 amendments, especially in history and science. They say their changes will correct what they call the present book's liberal bias. One person's bias, of course, is another's truth. So the Texas book battle is in full swing. Lucky Severson reports.
Do you think that the history that we have a lot of in this country was written by liberals?
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Don McElroy has been practicing dentistry for over 30 years, and until recently he was chairman of the Texas School Board, the board that stirred up a hornet's nest with its efforts to amend Texas history books for the state's nearly 5 million students.
Some people characterize, oh, we're making our standards lean to the right? Oh my gosh. You know, the left has dominated a lot of history.
Barbara Cargill has been on the board 6 years. She teaches science to children and agrees with McElroy on most issues.
We want to take all of the content that liberal publishers might have and want to pour into the classroom, and we serve as the filter for the parents and the students and the teachers to kind of make sure that what gets through is really the best information.
There are 15 state school board members here in Texas, 10 Republican, 5 Democrat. They're elected to 4-year terms, and every 10 years they're required to reevaluate and make any changes they deem necessary to Texas textbooks. But never before have there been so many changes, almost all of them from Republican members. Changes that ignore many of the recommendations Texas history teachers were mandated to make and spend a year compiling. This is Mary Helen Berlanga, a lawyer and a Democrat who has been on the school board longer than any other member.
Have you ever had anything like this in your 27 years?
No, never. And I think if you look at over the 300 amendments, you're going to see that it's a pretty much a rewrite of the original book that was given to us.
It's difficult for outsiders and even board members to make sense of all the amendments that have been offered, but most agree they paint conservatives and conservative values in a more favorable light. They extol the virtues of free enterprise and American foreign policy and emphasize that this country was built on Christian principles.
I would like to see the importance of religion to make sure that the role it played in the founding of our country and the acknowledgement of the founders' dependence upon God that they wrote into the documents, to make sure that that's clearly presented.
I am the mother of 2 Eagle Scouts myself, so it was very important to me that a lot of the values would be upheld in the social studies curriculum. And so throughout the elementary standards, you will see that our teachers are now required to teach their students about truthfulness, respect for oneself and for others, holding elected officials to their word, and you will see this language used over and over again, starting in kindergarten and going through the 4th grade.
It's my brother and I with 2 nephews.
Mary Helen Berlanga, like the other Democrats on the board, is a minority, and she argues that the contributions and treatment of minorities in Texas are whitewashed in the proposed standard changes.
When it comes to the section on civil rights, they do not have anything that is specific to the Mexican-American experience.
In Texas,
the Mexican-Americans were discriminated against. Mexican-Americans could not go into a restaurant and eat because on the outside it would say no Mexicans allowed, no dogs, no Negroes.
It's very disturbing. I'm very concerned for the kids in Texas, the students in Texas.
Fritz Fisher is a history professor at the University of Northern Colorado and chairman of the National Council for History Education. He believes board members should not be the ones to change history.
The standards should be written with people who work with the kids every day, who are professionally trained to do this sort of thing, and the government shouldn't be dictating, the political leader shouldn't be dictating what is taught in the classroom.
When Professor Fisher refers to the government, he's speaking of the elected school board members. He says most boards around the country make only a few changes to those submitted by the experts. McElroy himself added about 60 amendments.
The conservatives on our board, the only ones, the Christian conservatives, they're able to sit there and to think for themselves and say, well, wait, is this really good policy? Should we just trust what's being brought to us? Should we just rubber stamp it?
Some amendments were simply to change words or terminology. What was democratic societies becomes constitutional republics. Capitalism is no longer in favor. With this board, the preferred term is free enterprise.
One of the right-wing fanatics said that capitalism had a bad connotation, that people referred to us as a capitalist pig.
Lawrence Allen, a Democrat board member and an educator with 2 master's degrees, opposes changing the word capitalism.
I think there are a number of citizens today that say, well, I don't have a job, I don't have any money, so I don't know how wonderful the free enterprise system has been. I think that capitalism and these systems have made some of our citizens very fat and a large number of them very thin. And so I don't favor that at all.
The Teachers Review Committee recommended changing the word expansionism, as in American expansionism, to imperialism. The board rejected imperialism.
And there's no other way you can explain, for example, the United States taking over Hawaii. No, eventually Hawaii becomes a state. Eventually, it's integrated into the United States. But originally, in the 19th century, it was clearly imperialism. There's no other way to explain it.
The board's majority added an amendment that seems to justify the dark years of the McCarthy era. They believe documents known as the Venona Papers confirm suspicions of communist infiltration of the U.S. government.
The way the standard is written, as far as I've seen it so far, says that they must include information that exonerates McCarthy. In point of fact, the documents they're referring to do no such thing.
One of the chapters in this U.S. history book was called Nightmare at Omaha. And some of the board members were very concerned about what was covered on this page.
The Americans landing at Omaha Beach.
Right, landing at Omaha Beach.
So board members met with the book publisher and got the title changed from Nightmare at Omaha to A Day for Heroes.
The details of the battle are still here. However, because of the sacrifices made that day by our American soldiers, we want our students to learn that these men were truly heroes. And so it changes the tone that the teacher uses in the classroom, or if a student is reading the textbook, it changes their whole mindset. And this is what we want.
Theoretically, something like this could happen from the left someday as well as from the right. It's to focus on what is good history teaching and what is the purpose of history in the classroom. It's to teach judgment and critical thinking. It's not to teach a particular political version of the past.
They need to have an accurate view of history. Accuracy, balance, free of bias, and I'll vote for that every day of the week.
He won't be voting much longer, at least not on the board. McElroy was defeated in the recent election, but he'll continue to serve through the remainder of the year. The amendment process is not over yet. The Texas School Board meets one more time.
Might there still be more amendments then?
Absolutely, yeah.
Allen believes there may be far-reaching consequences to the board's final vote.
There are other elected officials that are watching this who are saying that maybe the state board has run its course because of some of what they call hijacking the public curriculum. And so there are state representatives and other legislators out there ready to do away with the power of the state board in this type of activity.
Texas purchases so many textbooks, it drives the price down so much, other states often buy exactly the same book. That's why educators around the country are watching what happens here very closely. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Corpus Christi.
The Texas School Board is now expected to vote on the new amendments on the 19th, 20th, and 21st of May. We have a story today about the poet and memoirist Mary Carr, whose book The Liars Club was a bestseller. Now Carr has a new book called Lit, about how she got out of alcoholism, drugs, physical abuse, and mental illness, and into the Catholic Church. Judy Valente reports.
Every poem probably has 60 drafts behind it.
Mary Carr talks about her love of poetry with students at a writer's conference in Michigan.
Hello, honey bun.
Carr was known mainly as a poet until her coming-of-age memoir, The Liars Club, became a bestseller in the 1990s. It was the vivid story of a sometimes hilarious but often brutal Texas childhood.
Here's a snapshot of your past, the past that you write about. Troubled family life, unstable childhood, alcoholism, divorce, depression, near suicide. Who is Mary Carr today?
Well, it's really been uphill since all that.
Carr reveals the rest of her story in a new memoir, a story summed up by its title, Lit, as in lit from within, by the literature she grew up with, by alcohol and drugs, and finally, lit by a faith she found unexpectedly in the Catholic Church.
No one in the Catholic Church hired me as a spokesperson, nor would they. I'm sure I'm not the Pope's favorite Catholic, nor is he mine.
Carr grew up amid the hard scrabble oil fields of East Texas. Her father drank himself to death. Her mother was married 7 times.
Well, I'm somebody who really does feel like I was snatched out of the fire and found something in myself that's luminous and gives me ballast.
The road to faith was a long, hard climb for someone who once described herself as an undiluted agnostic. By her mid-30s, Carr's life had begun to unravel. Her marriage was failing. She drank heavily, wrecked the family car, was hospitalized for an emotional breakdown. In desperation, she took a friend's advice and reluctantly began to pray.
I would kind of bounce on my knees and I would say, higher power, please keep me sober today, whatever they told me to say. And then at night I would say, thank you for keeping me sober today. And then I started to express myself, which was often, with obscene gestures, double barrel at the light fixtures.
Carr was newly separated and trying to stay sober when her 5-year-old son asked her to take him to church.
And I said, why? And he said the only sentence he could have said that would have gotten me to church, he said, to see if God's there. And I thought, oh, okay.
Carr took her son to various churches, a process she dubbed the God-orama. She would sit with a paperback and a cup of coffee while he searched for God.
We got out, we got in the car, and he's buckling his seatbelt, and I said, so was God there? And he's like, well, yeah. Like, where were you? So that was when I decided that for him, we would find a place of worship.
Carr says she still equated most organized religions with something people just did socially. Then one day she passed a Catholic church in Syracuse, New York, where she was teaching. She was struck by a banner out front. It said, Sinners Welcome.
I thought I had a better shot at becoming a pole dancer at 40, right, than making it in the Catholic church. And I think what struck me really wasn't the grandeur of the Mass. It was the simple faith of the people. For me, this whole journey was a journey into awe. I would just get these moments of quiet where there wasn't anything, and it was, my head would shut up. And I knew that that was a good thing. And also the carnality of the church. There was a body on the cross.
Father Bruno Shaw, a Dominican friar, is a close friend who has written about Carr's work.
In the Catholic Church, above the altar, one sees a cross with the body on it. The body is there. The corpus of Christ is there, bleeding, still, in the midst of the world. And that's, I think, really what got to her. Her experience of being a sinner, her experience of being a sinner and recognizing that this does not distinguish her from anybody else in the world.
Many of her recent poems reimagine the life of Christ. She sees in poetry a form of prayer.
Poetry is, for me, Eucharistic. You take someone else's suffering into your body, their passion comes into your body, and in doing that, you commune, you take communion, you make a community with others.
Carr has been sober for 20 years, but she still prays to keep her demons at bay.
I don't have much virtue now. It's really, all of it is grace for me. All of it is given. I'm a very venal, I want to eat all the chocolate and snort all the cocaine and kiss all the boys.
The fact that this person would turn around so drastically is compelling. She sees all the alcoholics who don't make it. She sees all the good chances that have been given to her for no good reason. And she asks in wonder and thanksgiving to God, why me? And that's a great testimony to her faith and to the authenticity of her conversion.
I've been reading a lot.
A conversion, she says, transformed every aspect of her life.
My goal in writing about my faith wasn't to proselytize, even though I did feel called in prayer to write about it, but to try to make a bridge between people who had been like myself, completely unbaptized, completely without faith, a bridge between that, and to bring them into the experience of faith.
Carr says she hopes her turbulent past provides more than just a good story, but also sends out a message of hope to others. With her characteristic wry humor, she still refers to herself as a black belt sinner, but a lucky one nonetheless.
I've never contended that I had a really horrible life. I feel like Jesus does like me better than he does all of you.
For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Judy Valente in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Finally, archaeologists and adventurers have long searched for Noah's Ark, and now a new group claims to have found it. Turkish and Chinese scientists say they discovered an ancient wooden structure in a remote area on Turkey's Mount Ararat. They say carbon dating found the wood to be almost 5,000 years old. Many scientists and historians around the world are already debunking the claims, but just in case, local Turkish officials are urging that the UN give the site international heritage status. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. We'd like to hear from you. You can follow us on our Facebook page. We also have much more on our website, including more of Judy Valente's interview with writer Mary Carr. You can comment on all of our stories and share them. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, scenes from the funeral this week of civil rights leader Dorothy Height at the Washington National Cathedral.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.